profitability look like in a world like that? And you see, you know, market value $9.24 billion in 2008, and it's gotten bigger since. What could be credible up there when those kinds of figures and values are flying around? And then atomistic. And by this, I mean, the only reason I chose that word is because I couldn't find an appropriate antonym for holistic. It is the processes of assessment are generally speaking project-specific or industry-specific. They are anthropocentric, generally speaking, even though there is some consideration of impacts to animals and those kinds of things. And to my mind, the commonality of these various ways of conflicts occurring, it primarily results from the fact that they're focused upon minute aspects, you know, facets, blinkered views of certain things. And I find that to be very difficult because the indigenous traditions that I come from and that really inspire me reject that hypothesis because it's self-evident that it's not true. It's utterly discredited by lived experience. Go spend a day on the land and you recognize that, you know, making a fire is related to the growth of the trees, which is related to the water, which is related to the animals, which, you know, the world is connected. It always has been. Every breath we take, that becomes true. It's clear to us. And yet, for some reason, it's just one application. It's just one lease sale. It's just one seismic activity. You know, and that's an interesting thing. And then, of course, environmental injustice. This is the other side of it. This is Lakota and Wet'suwet'en and United to Fight. And this is the response. This is what's coming. More and more. Now, how do we respond to it? And I'll try and get through this part with the utmost respect as quickly as I can. This is taken from John Borrow's work. And the relevant point with this primarily, I mean, I believe we live in a legally pluralistic state. For the lawyers in the room, I'm not going to go into too much of the theory stuff, but essentially multiple legal orders existing in the same space. Very simple concept. Civil law, common law, indigenous law. The point that's really important for me is this. What happens? Where is it applied? Now, if you take one thing away from this, aside from my awesome hair tonight, it's that there is space in the conflicts that I've just showed you for recognition of an issue, recognition of a need for an answer, resources because of the massive profitability, the massive scientific potential of these processes, the massive wisdom of both Western and non-Western thinkers looking at these issues, and the question of jurisdiction deriving primarily from indigenous people's presence on the land before the colonizer. I think you have all of these requirements potentially in unconventional energy. That's the very simple thesis. And for those of you guys who knew me back in the day, that was the thesis I had when I was working for West Moberly. It's a simple point that we can actually deal with this because the kind of fights we're seeing require this. Recognize there's an issue, recognize that there might be a solution, pull some of the resources being wasted litigating and fighting and you know, scrapping in courts, which I mean is good for the lawyers, but might not be so good for long-term sustainable solutions, well, in some ways, and just grant some jurisdiction. That's all that's required for a different legal order to manifest and at least try to fix something. What might that look like? Now, there's lots of things I could talk about, UN DRIP, a million examples of indigenous laws coming forward, UVic's program, the Akitsirak, I mean, the work of people in this room. This is one thing I wanted to share. This is done, I think, about 11 days ago.
Yeah.
This is, Aboriginal law section. This is big stuff. CBA, Canadian Bar Association, put this forward, and it was moved. This is our profession, for those of us involved in the legal profession in this room, stepping up to the plate and recognizing that we really have to move forward. Some people in this room are very, very actively involved in this, and that's one of the reasons I put it up here. I wanted to honor that. This is an example of these laws coming forward. So we're getting the recognition. We're moving forward. Now, reconciliation. One of the often posited rules and ideas about indigenous laws and the use of indigenous laws for indigenous people is reconciliation. I have a problem with that. This is where me and a lot of people differ, because I don't really believe in reconciliation as preached by the courts. Despite the fact that I'm Treaty 8 and that I'm compelled to live in peace and friendship with the colonizer, I don't buy reconciliation between two cultures. That's not the reconciliation I think was embedded in the law and in our treaties. Because a reconciliation built upon human-to-human relationships is innately myopic and emaciated. It doesn't include everything that's relevant. I mean, it's good It puts to bed some pretty serious and deep, dark, divisive issues that have torn apart this country and blackened our names collectively. But it's not the reconciliation we need for the kind of conflicts I've shared with you tonight. I think reconciliation means something bigger, and I would like to deploy indigenous legal principles to achieve a bigger reconciliation, the reconciliation between my people and the colonizers. I would like that to be dealt with. Don't get me wrong, that'd be lovely. Sort that shit out. But but that's, oh God, I'm swearing. But that's not the beauty and the wisdom of what was put in the treaties. It wasn't reconciliation between the colonizer and the colonized. It was reconciliation between peoples and the land and all that sustained them. That's what I think the beautiful possibility is. Now, why? Because we get past this anthropocentric construction. And anthropocentric constructions and notions that we are somehow at the top of the food chain are ridiculous. And again, in the face of lived experience, if you spend time out in the land. Two, you respond to uncertainty. In Northeast BC, in unconventional energy development in particular, you see a lot of contamination. You see uncertainty around contamination. You see uncertainty with the business. And of course, that's why you lock down long-term water licenses, because of climate change. You don't know if you're going to have water to frack in 20 years. So you lock it down now because of first-in-time, first-in-right water allocation system. And community conflict as a result. These uncertainties, we don't know what's going to happen here, require this bigger, deeper notion of reconciliation to my mind. And my point is that if this kind of reconciliation were to occur, both inter and intra-community reconnections would be created. Even in the indigenous community, the line between those who advocate for contracting opportunities and development and sustainable development versus those who are very traditional and say, absolutely not, just get off the land, you want a land back. I think there's still space for those people to come together and for those collectives to come together with the larger collectives that we all share. You know, as was famously said, we're all here to stay. Now, I don't believe that. Our survival was never guaranteed. It's always been contingent on the land. That's the nature of being human. That's the nature of being a living thing in this place and time and living on this earth. We have a contingent existence. We don't have a right to it. We have responsibility to try and give it to our kids in the best situation and condition as we can. And so I think this is required. And the base point, I'm not sure if you guys can see, I'm kind of in your way, is that I like the precautionary approach and active adaptive management systems, because they attempt to engage with these questions of uncertainty. And I'm not sure how many people in the room know what this is. You guys seen this before? Does anyone know what that is? There might be a few. No? Okay. It's a really interesting little series of graphs. This is a population from the 1350s. This is water use in kilometers per year globally since 1900. This is paper consumption since 1900. This is fertilizer consumption since 1950. Damming of major rivers since 1850. Atmospheric ambient CO2 concentration since 1350. We're up above 360 at this point. Atmospheric ozone depletion since 1960. Now, all of these graphs look the same, and I think there's a big implication there. And that's the other reason why I think we need this kind of reconciliation, especially in the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin, because it's the second largest hydrocarbon deposit on Earth, because we are global players. And if we solve this problem, we become global players in creating a global solution, at least parts of it. And I think that's a beautiful thing. That's a reconciliation I can get behind.